Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome again to the second portion of the first hour of Mind Shifters Radio. And I'm just going to check with Susan to make sure that you're able to hear me.
I can hear you just fine. I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Yeah, we've lost half our callers, but we're back. And so maybe they will rejoin us.
God.
Thank you all for dialing back in, those of you who did. And we were discussing the concept of the pain body. And again, it's just a collection of thoughts. So if it's useful for you, Susan, to think about the pain body as something that incorporates all of your anxieties and all of your wanting to fix people, whatever you would call your addiction or your codependence, if that's useful for you, if it gives you a sense of where to apply the tools that you find most effective, then use it. But if you get hung up on it and you're trying to make your experience fit with what you understand from the readings or the writings of someone like Krishnamurti or Eckhart Tolle, then let it go, because you know we are encouraging everyone with this work that we do to be results oriented. We want everybody to be getting tapped into their own personal guidance. We want people to be moving consistently toward more loving, more effective, more joyful experience of life, more gratitude for the gift of life itself. And so anything you do that helps that process, we want to support you in doing. Any thought process or application of a tool that takes you further away from that, we would be happy to support you in releasing. I've had a number of conversations with people in the past few weeks, months really, about all of the talk about the politics and all of the war between good and evil that's seemingly going on in the world. And my message for all of these people remains the same. If it's useful for you, if you're feeling empowered, if you're feeling more peaceful and loving, the more you watch those YouTube videos and, you know, uncover the hidden dynamics in the politics and the deep state, and if that leaves you feeling more loving and peaceful, by all means, do it. If it gets you all ramped up, tense, nervous, angry, scared, hurt, confused, bitter, resentful, any of those negative emotions, we would encourage you to use the tools, whether the ones that Michael and Jeannie make available at whyagain.org, or any tools you can find, whether it's Byron Katie's work or Ho'oponopono or the Four Agreements or the Sedona Release Method, to actually start shifting your thought process to one in which there is the space for you to be grateful for the breath of life that is allowing you to have your awareness If I'm not, if I wake up in the morning and I'm not grateful for the gift of life, I'm missing an opportunity. So
okay.
I don't want to say too much more about the construct of the pain body, except to say that it is a construct, and if you're using it in a way that helps you, feel free to keep using it.
Okay, well, what you said helped me realize that I haven't quite asked the question the way I needed to ask it. Years and years ago, there was a practitioner in New York City that Tim Bingham went to. He did what they called bioenergetics. Have you ever heard of that?
Well, I've heard that term.
Yeah. I don't know what it means either. But the man he worked with, Tim worked with him for some time, told Tim that he needed to discover and express to the nth degree, not by murder, but express in a safe way, his rage against his father. And he had various tools. He gave Tim these padded bats. They called them bataka bats. And you could hit a person pretending that person is your father. Or if you're married to somebody and are mad at them, you could both have a bataka bat and you'd hit each other and you'd have rules about not hitting in the face or the genitals or whatever. But you use these tools and you get your rage out. And this was the big thing. I've also heard it said that when you let your rage out, it's not healthy. You're stressing your heart and your blood pressure could go up, and it's actually better to relax into it and let it pass and just watch it, whatever. And so I'm just puzzling about how much feeling, and I have a lot of feelings these days about my son particularly, how much feeling should be welcomed and invited in and experienced, and in what ways, and what not, because the worksheet tends to kind of truncate that. It says allow, let it, take a look at it, write down a goal, and you get to do some work, and you get through it without going into a tirade. So I'll stop there and see. I hear you taking breaths.
It's an absolute truth that we went through a period of time in psychotherapy and psychiatry and whatnot where people thought that was a good thing to do. There was primal scream therapy, there was bataka bat therapy, etc. And I believe if you do the research on that these days, you'll find out that people who actually did research on it discovered it's not productive. And I just went to my bookshelf and got a book, which is the 20th anniversary edition of a book. And in the original book, so here's the foreword to the 20th anniversary edition of this book. Here's the first thing, here's the second thing, and thirdly, the most substantive revision in this book at the 20th anniversary is replacing the original chapter 11 with an entirely new chapter. This chapter used to be titled Containing Rage. And it was designed to help couples express their anger and frustration that they had carried over from childhood. And the chapter described an exercise called the full container, and it guided each participant in venting his or her anger while helping the other person to listen with compassion. At the time, we believed that this catharsis would reduce the amount of tension in their day-to-day interactions. The opposite proved to be true. We discovered that the more couples practiced the exercise, the angrier they became with each other in their daily lives. And the research proved that, essentially, the bataka bat, the screaming into a pit in the ground, the get your rage out, it leads to mob rule. It leads to fueling the rage. So now the entirely new chapter 11 is titled Creating a Sacred Space. It's on diffusing the anger left over from childhood, etc. So that's my answer to what you're coming. Yes, it was a very real thing, and there were movements, there were revolutions about. There were actually bataka bats sold in therapist magazines. So yeah, it was a very real thing, not a useful thing, but a very real thing.
That is
so.
So
now we come to you. So what do you do with your emotions? Well, what we try and get people to do in this work is use them as a part of a guidance system. But rather than having it, assume that what my anger is here to tell me is that I'm right and the other person's wrong, assume that my anger is there to help me understand how I am misperceiving actuality, and apply a tool which helps me discover what are the missteps in perception that David Bohm would call sustained incoherence, that Krishnamurti would call thinking and mistaking the word as the thing, or Krishnamurti would call knowing rather than questioning. So my emotions are real. They're energies, and they flow, and they've got all kinds of good information for me. One of the ways that I talk about it most in this work, especially since encountering Dr. Rice's work and Jeannie's work, is the idea that my emotions are most useful in my system as wake-up calls to the actuality that my thought process is in error, that I am off the mark.
Okay.
And then
if I
dig into some kind of an exploratory process that helps me uncover the part of my mind energy that I'm hiding from myself, I start to see all kinds of options I never saw before. Go ahead.
Oh, it's just helpful because I've been thinking about addiction, but even to call it an addiction isn't really useful. It's just erroneous. It's just erroneous anyway. And I am thinking in terms of sobriety from rerunning the stories all the time. But that's very funny about the whole research getting put on its head. I wonder how John Perakis, he was the bioenergetics man. He isn't alive anymore. I wonder if he lived long enough to read what you just read. Oh my gosh, pull his hair out. Yeah. His whole life was based on teaching people to express their rage and do it and do it and do it and do it.
Yeah. And there, like I said, there were people that ran seminars for primal scream therapy, or they would take people out into the woods and have them dig a hole in the ground and lay on the ground with their head over the hole and scream and scream and scream and scream.
Mm-hmm.
Whole weekends devoted to stuff like that.
It sounds kind of fun in a way, but I guess it didn't help. Oh, that's so interesting. Yeah. Okay, well, that was my question.
Well, I think that, but before we leave that, and you're talking about your use of the term addiction, I think that it may be very valuable to talk about addiction, but only when you have what we would call an operational definition for addiction. And Dr. Michael Rice provides that. He doesn't really call it an operational definition, but if you define something not in abstract terms, but you define it by how it operates.
Mm-hmm.
That's an operational definition. So when you say addiction in this work, the way Michael Rice talks about it, is the compulsive use. That's an important part of this definition. I feel compelled to do this over and over and over again. It's the compulsive use of anything, any person, any substance, food, activity, that I use to either block myself from feeling my pain or discomfort, numb myself out from that pain or discomfort, or keep me from seeing and then acting on my highest guidance. So if you use that definition, I think it's quite useful to talk about addiction. And yes, even your addiction with this, I want to change people in my family or I want to fix people, all the way up to I want to, you know, have a few beers every night when I go home. Anything I'm doing, any personal interaction with somebody, any food, any substance, any activity that keeps me from, that I'm compulsively using to keep me from feeling my pain, to numb me out to that pain or block that pain, or to keep me from seeing and acting on my highest guidance.
It's the latter one with me. The telling of the same story, the reiterating the list of fears and terrible outcomes and all that stuff. It's a habit. It's a broken record habit. And there may be truth in some of it, but it's not useful to run those tapes. So the lesson yesterday or the day before, I mean, it's a combination of them. I can see things another way. I can choose peace. All of those are like little spades that dig under the tamped down soil of those habits and loosen it up. And I have been feeling a lot of sorrow about my son because of the suffering he goes through and has since he was I was remembering back, first grade, we were out in Colorado on a concert tour, a whole bunch of us. And I had a babysitter at home. And here's this little guy going to school for the first time, first grade. He comes home in a panic because he doesn't know how to read and thinks he was supposed to already know how to read. And he's in a terror about this. And I get a call from the babysitter saying he's thrown himself on the floor. He's screaming and crying because he doesn't know how to read. And I can't seem to tell him that he doesn't have to know how to read. He's supposed to be learning how to read from scratch. And so what if another kid knows how to read? He doesn't have to know how to read yet. And I talked my son down from this terror that he had that he didn't measure up. He wasn't worthy. He was stupid. And then in grade school, they formed a group called the Talented and Gifted Kids. My son was not chosen for that. He's dyslexic. He's ambidextrous, dyslexic, had trouble reading. He wasn't picked. He came home and said, "See, I am stupid." And every day in school, the Talented and Gifted Kids were separated from the others and taken on some kind of an extracurricular something or other. And the dumbbells were left behind. Now, I'm ranting about the educational system in the public school and what they could do to hurt kids. But all of this sadness is roiling up, and I'm thinking to myself, is this part of my addiction, or is this needing to come to the light, yeah, and do worksheets on? Yeah, I'm answering my own question. But it's just amazing how much feeling there is about that. So I guess calling an addiction is a way of stuffing it down again, and that isn't useful. Yeah, okay. You're helping me sort these things through.
Well, I would say that it may be the addiction, and if you define it as we just did, that it's the compulsive use of these thought patterns and these negative emotions to keep you from facing your own highest guidance, or to keep you from feeling and processing through your own sadness. And, you know, then in this work, the solution is beautifully simple and readily available, free. I do worksheets. I do tapping and breathing. I do reality management worksheets, and I do mind shifter targeted journaling, and I make the commitment to keeping myself focused on healing what's less than loving in my thought patterns, and then I'm doing the best I can for myself and my entire bloodline. And my experience of using these tools all these years is it's my life just gets better.
Mm. So it doesn't matter if you have a crying jag. It doesn't matter. It just can be rolled into the process of doing the worksheets and looking at the thought disorders. Doesn't matter.
Yeah, I'm. You kind of lost me when you said it doesn't matter if you have a crying jag. What are you referring to?
Well, I'm hearing
are you thinking that, if you have an episode of intense emotions and it's accompanied by tears, that you're somehow doing something wrong?
Or it's fanning the flames of the addiction.
It could be if I let myself fall into that to the exclusion of doing my work. But I love the story from, it's probably from one of the Anthony DeMello books. But there's a story about the guru who was, you know, teaching his students that, you know, a guru or a yogi, we don't have moods.
Yes.
We don't get stuck in that stuff. And then one day they were together when the news came that one of his favorite disciples had been tragically killed at a young age. And his disciples were around him, and he began to cry. And they said, "Master, how could this be?" And he looked at him and he said, "What can I say? My eyes are crying." Now, he's not going to throw himself into, you know, the energy of the thoughts that would make it more and more intense, but he's not going to deny that he's crying either.
Yeah, that's beautiful. That's a great story. Perfect. All right.
So, does that fill the cup for now?
Yes, thanks.
All right, let me turn on the microphone for, I believe it's Ellen. Are you there?
Yes, I am. Hello, Dr. Tim. Hi, Susan.
Hi.
I just wanted to go back to, and actually you guys are talking about it even now, the expression of, it could be rage or sadness, whatever the emotion is. I mean, what I understand is that if you're raging or if you're crying because of the story, because you're involved in the story, then yes, it is absolutely just going to give more fuel to the fire of that story and your experiences around your false beliefs that are associated with it. But I also believe that these deep emotions can come up as part of what I guess Michael refers to as a healing crisis, where it's actually just the release of this energy that has been suppressed. And while you're allowing those emotions to come forward, which I think is a very healthy thing to do, you're not caught up in the story. You're like, there's a part of you that is just witnessing this and saying, "Oh, look, this is coming up for healing, and I am just going to let it all come out." And so I think in certain cases, rage coming up or the sadness, whatever it is the expression of that is very healing. It all depends on whether it's part of, you know, doing your work, and so it's part of a healing crisis, or whether it's just coming up because you're continuing to believe in your story. And I just wanted to get your thoughts on that, Dr. Tim.
Well, I think it's very, very much like what we were just saying with the story about the guru who says, what can I say? My eyes are crying. So if I allow the experience of these emotions and I understand that there's just it's energy moving and it has information for me, then it's a matter of what do I do with that information? Do I use that information to formulate a thought system that says, I'm crying because of someone or something outside of me, or I use that information to say, oh, I have energy moving, let me explore it. Let me see how the thought process that I'm using is generating this upset, and then use tools to dismantle anything that's erroneous in that thought process. You know, I think most of the really good systems say, my experience of my emotions is a healthy thing. My allowing these energies to flow and flow through me is far more beneficial than trying to stuff them down, deny them, or let them carry me away and dictate all kinds of behaviors that might be counterproductive or even destructive to myself and others. I mean, I can learn to contain, allow and feel my sadness without having to let it drive my behaviors. You know, I'm routinely these days, I'm sitting with people who are they're plugged into YouTube videos and theories about how there's a major war going on between good and evil on the planet, and it involves aliens and it involves deep state, and they're constantly pouring into these, they're pouring that stuff into their brain, and they're generating all kinds of unpleasant, scared, confused, hurt, angry emotions. And they're describing those to me, and they're being really stuck in a session. And I feel my own sadness, frustration, irritability. And if I try to deny that I'm feeling that, it's not helpful. At the same time, if I try to blame those emotions on the person sitting in front of me and what they're reporting, that's not helpful.
Right.
So if I can allow it, I mean, there have been probably in this past year, because of the coronavirus and the intensity of people's issues and sessions, probably more than any time in the past 46 years, I've actually come to tears in the middle of therapy sessions. And I don't try to hide those tears from the people in the sessions. If I did, I think that'd be a big mistake. Now, that doesn't mean that I say, okay, your session's over, now you have to be here and supporting me resolving my emotions. But I acknowledge the emotions as energy, and I let it guide my application of the tools. And again, the purpose of the tools is just to help me have a more accurate, something closer to true perception. So, I believe we are at the end of our first hour. So thank you both, and all of you who've called back in. And I'll mute you both and remind us all that we come from love, and we're made of the stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. And hopefully Jeannie Rice is there to step in. Welcome, Jeannie Rice.
I am. I didn't unmute myself on the switchboard. So, yeah, I've been listening since about 25 after. I wanted to make sure that it switched over. And so other than having to hear the intro again, that was a pretty smooth transition, I think. You did well.
Thank you. Have a lovely show.
Thanks. So welcome, everybody, to the second hour of Mind Shifters Radio. Today is Wednesday, February the 3rd, 2021, and our call-in number is 563-999-3581, and press 1, and that puts you into queue to talk to us. And I hear Michael's already picked up with us. So welcome, Michael.
Thank you, dear heart, and welcome, everybody. We are once again honored and delighted that you're here to assist in moving this conversation about first century Aramaic forgiveness forward on a global scale, making it available to more and more minds every day. And we're going to pick up on our reading from the chapter on feelings, our guidance system, chapter 4 in the book. And we're on page 20, if you want to pick up and join us there. And I was just in the middle of doing a feelings exercise, or pardon me, a checking in on emotions exercise with the character Richard in the book when we completed yesterday. And I had pointed out to him as he touched the place where he was experiencing some of his energetic movement that his hand was on his own structure. And he's stepped in to interrupt, and I'm just going to ask him to hold on for a moment. So let me just go through the rest of the exercise, Richard, before we get into a discussion. Would you close your eyes again for a moment? We've just had him close his eyes and let himself go through different emotions. So take a deep breath. And where you felt sadness, allow yourself to be aware of where that sadness is. Take a breath and let it go. Allow yourself to be aware of where the fear was. Take a breath, let it go. Where was the anger? Be aware of where that is in your physiology. Take a breath, let it go. And then that pain that you're feeling, let yourself be aware of where that is. And let your breath go to that pain. Let it soften and let it loose. You know, it's interesting when we begin to treat pain as a sensation rather than as something terrible, oftentimes its whole character and nature changes. So I ask him to just let those things go, and then ask him to tap into the feeling of joy and aliveness. And ask him to open his eyes, and he instantly says, "That feels better. How did you feel each of the emotions that you just had?" "I recall an experience that caused those feelings in me, previously, I guess. "And what did you do to recall that experience? What specific was the mechanical process?" He says, "I'm not sure what you're asking. What happened in your mind to get each of those feelings you just felt?" He says, "Well, I thought about something that caused those feelings. Is that what you mean?" "Yes, sort of. Notice, to feel a feeling, you had to think. You had a thought, right? Feelings, and here, you know, we've been substituting the word emotions. There was a distinction I did not have 30 years ago when I wrote the book between feelings and emotions. So emotions are shadows of thoughts," I offered. "In the last 2 minutes, you had several different emotions, correct?" "Yes." "And whose thoughts caused those feelings?" "Mine, I guess," he said, looking a little confused. "But I had the feelings because of the event I thought about, not because of the thoughts I had." "It sure looks that way, but I think it actually works differently, Richard. What was one of the scenes you thought of in order to feel anger?" "Oh, I just had to think of my wife leaving me and being alone as a result of her action," he said. "What if you were to think about her leaving and at the same time hold the thought, I'm ready to do my whole life differently. What an opportunity to heal." He says, "But I would never think like that, Michael. After this experience, you just might change your mind. Give it a try, see what happens. Get into thinking about her leaving and allow yourself to generate thoughts of excitement about doing your life differently and the opportunity to heal. Think those thoughts as true, exciting thoughts about your life and just see what happens." "Well, I'm not feeling angry. Actually, I feel anticipation how life could be." But that's not true. I'm angry with her." "Notice, Richard, it is your thought about the event and not the event itself that causes your feelings. You can choose to hold on to your angry thoughts, but when you do, you get the original. Your wife just gets a carbon copy. Your thoughts impact you first. Take notice. She's not here. She doesn't know what you're thinking. But each thought has an impact on you. Your emotions inform you of the nature of the impact of the energy of your thoughts on your physiology. If you're in pain, you're the one who's in error. My thoughts cause my emotions. What a novel concept, Richard Half mumbled to himself. Let's take the principle a step further. If yesterday, last week, last month, last year, you had a negative feeling or pain, whose thought caused you to feel that pain? Mine, he acknowledged. If tomorrow, next week, next month, next year, you experience that quality of pain, whose thought will be the cause of your pain? Obviously mine, was a short reply. Do you expect to experience pain at some time in the future, I inquire? Well, of course, won't everyone? Well, I'm not sure that's necessary, Richard. Why would you inflict pain on yourself? I don't know, habit, I guess. There's only one reason, insanity. You mean I'm insane? To the degree that we each inflict pain on ourselves, Richard, we are all insane. The world teaches us insane thought systems, and in so doing, it teaches us to destroy ourselves. If we buy in and think insane thinking is normal, we will reach the conclusion that we have no other choice. Thoughts, I would offer, are a form of energy. Whenever you put a quality of mind energy into your physiology, you get a feeling that corresponds to that quality. Those emotions are your feedback mechanism and tell you whether you're engaging in constructive or destructive mind energy. When you make a mistake, the emotion is negative. I would offer that you and I are made in the image of lightness of love, and that there's no other reality that belongs in the human experience. Any other reality is a violation of the human structure, and we destroy ourselves when we focus on disintegrative energies. He thought here, if I'm in pain, my thinking is in error. We build our realities literally with each piece of mind energy in which we engage. The mind has the amazing capacity to turn our mind energy into the actual images we see. If you put hate, fear, anger, anguish, terror, criticism, condemnation, gossip, slander, and vengeance into your structure, that mind energy will turn into an image in your brain. If you're in denial, you'll think the image is about somebody else, though it comes from your physiology. Every image your mind produces explains where you are. If you can't own that, you'll never be able to see yourself accurately, and the connection will be impossible. One of the goals of this work is to provide a variety of tools for correction. So what we're offering here is that our emotions are nothing more than a feedback mechanism, and they're just telling us of the quality of our creative process. And when we realize that we are each creative beings, it's like the Creator gave us a guidance system to tell us when our creative process was off base. And each painful emotion is a feedback mechanism to teach us, to inform us, to keep us on our toes and recognizing what it is that we're doing to ourselves. But of course, the world teaches us all kinds of denial and wants us to pretend that the replicate thoughts we think, and, you know, people will do this thing of, well, you know, I went to a therapist, and this therapist told me you never talk about the past. Well, I'll tell you what, if you never talk about the past and you never go in and clean it up, then you are condemned to repeat it unconsciously over and over and over and over again. And if you've ever said to yourself, why is this happening to me again? If you've ever recognized yourself in a place where, yeah, boy, I remember experiencing this as a kid, and here I am, you're doing it to me now. It's like, well, I guess you could hold on to that lie and believe that, you know, what happened to you 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago is being caused by someone outside of you. Or maybe you could actually grow up into an actual adult and go, my thoughts cause my emotions. Maybe this whole state of mind that I have belongs to me. Maybe it doesn't belong to you. Maybe you're not the cause of it. And maybe if I actually grew to adulthood, I could stop playing the why is this happening to me again experience by being willing to go back and confront those things directly. You know, there's that old saying that the brave dies once, the coward 1,000 times. What does that mean? The person who refuses to review their past, to review that which they've not yet dealt with, is condemned to repeat it over and over and over. Yes, going in directly and dealing with it once, that can be a big shock. It can be quite a trauma. But when I recognize and take responsibility that I have the opportunity to change those past dynamics only by looking at them and by standing in a space of willingness that allows me to embrace them and move through them. And so the bottom line of this work is to stand in that space of willingness where I can own whatever's going on inside of me, and I can choose to move through those things. I can choose to move beyond those things. And we're here to create support for understanding at depth what it is that we are doing to ourselves, and to step into the space of willingness to own and undo those things rather than the relentless belief, why are you doing this to me again? And you'll notice if you've got a particular painful reality that you've been through 87 different times with 42 different people, you're the only one that was there every time. It's about you. It's not about them. But when we live in denial, we condemn ourselves to repeating the experience. So we're looking to undo that state of denial. And our definition of denial in this work is simply the act of thinking or speaking as though something outside of me is the cause of what's happening inside of me. When I move out of that unconscious dynamic, I get to change everything in my world, because I get to start to become a conscious creator, and it becomes necessary for me to look at the past dynamics. You know, obviously, in the title, Why Is This Happening to Me Again?, it implies there is a past. And if I never choose to responsibly embrace the past, then the past reality structures that I've built out of denial, I will tend to repeat and repeat and repeat and wonder how it could possibly happen that way. And so that's kind of the bottom line of where we're heading with Richard as a character, and where we're heading in understanding these tools and digging into the deepest hidden parts of the mind, those things that flow from the past, and being willing to undo them. You know, I gave an example the other day of a particular healing crisis that I went into, and the whole beginning point of that was literally to look at a thought disorder that I was totally oblivious to, one that just came to, you know, kind of seemingly out of nowhere into awareness. And it was something that happened in very, very, very early childhood. unless I'd been willing to look at that, unless I'd been willing to allow that past to come forward and embrace it directly and choose to hold it in a space of active love, which is the basic principle of healing. You know, if every time one of those past things comes up, you go into all kinds of anger and pissiness and moaning and complaining and blaming and puking on others or puking on yourself, then you just add more energy to repeating the pattern again and again and again. So we're here to put an end to the why is this happening to me again experience, step by step, piece by piece, and to provide the tools and support for doing that. So, Miss Jeannie, do we have anybody out there in the phone queue with a hand up or anything happening in the chat room? Well, that was good.
We do have a hand up, and I believe that it's Grady. Area code 704, you're on the air.
Hi. How's everybody doing today?
Hey there, young man. Welcome. We're rocking. How about you?
Rocking. I am also rocking. Really enjoyed the material and discussion yesterday. And I want to thank whoever raised that question. It was very timely for me to hear about the relationship between setting or what was involved in setting Rachma and Kuba.
Good.
I thought
that was meaningful.
Your description was so good. I'm actually listening to it now for the second time. I'm making notes on it, and I'm going to use that conversation, Michael, in the work that I'm teaching on your Beatitudes.
Sweet.
In the use of things and the parallels that come into this, I'll not overly chat about it, but
go for it. Go for it. If that was meaningful to you yesterday, and this is an outgrowth, who knows who it's going to be meaningful today if you do chat us up on it.
Well, your broad concept of guidance system, and you talk about that in chapter 4 extensively, introduce it to Richard in the book, and you talk so nicely about it yesterday, and bringing in the thoughts tied to feelings, one being more of a catalyst or a cause, and the other being the effect, the feeling being the sensation of, you know, the output of the thought. So what came to mind in my mind yesterday, and I was going to call and make a comment on it, was when you do align Rachma and Kuba, am I correct in assuming that that yields the possibility of true perception, that fifth smooth stone?
Well,
that when Rachma and Kuba are properly set. Okay.
Well, when both are set, we then are in the space where we can clean up the whole perceptual apparatus, and the end result of cleaning up the apparatus will be accurate perception, or what we could call true perception, meaning that everything that comes from carbon-based memory will then be accurate. And if you look at the chart from the Laws of Living class, we actually created an upgrade from that and made note that the fifth smooth stone in that regard was enlightened perception. And that is where we've quieted carbon-based memory with all of its past. I mean, anything that comes from carbon-based memory is obviously from the past. In order to represents itself, it had to be there in the first place. And so perception through carbon-based memory can give us all accurate information about the actuality of the moment, but it can't give us that actuality. So it's going to be accurate, it's going to be true, but it's still not the event. When we can get to the point where we can collapse, you know, we've said before, in order to heal, you've got to be out of your mind. When we get to the point where we're willing to collapse carbon-based memory, so it shuts up and there's this clean and open space, then the higher faculties can come in and give us the actual event, a taste of the actual event, which we, if you remember in Laws of Living, we labeled as enlightened perception. So we changed
there's
five smooth stones. We changed that fifth smooth stone back in Laws of Living, the one you were at when we shifted that, or just after that, into enlightened perception, going beyond true perception. That would be my take at this point.
Okay. All right. So that certainly encourages the use of the forgiveness tool to do your cleanup work. And then after the level of purification occurs, you move into the enlightened perception, which then opens the door for accurate and true, well, and true, or is it the other way around?
Well, I would put it, you know, to try and get the language clarified, I would put that once carbon-based memory is cleaned up and the inaccuracies are removed, every bit of information that is resonated in it by actuality is accurate. It's true. But it's still generated perception out of the past. But at least it's accurate about the actuality. What we're looking to do ultimately is to make room for the actuality to enter.
All right.
Which goes the next step beyond that.
Thank you. Okay. All right. So we're cleaning up our perception of the past that's stored in us so that it is accurate, so that then we're able to, we'll have the opportunity to accommodate true perception or of actuality, or actuality, or at least get to
that point, the actuality writes meaning directly in our minds.
Gotcha.
It doesn't have to go through carb-based memory.
Through that step. Okay, yeah. Great.
And you've heard me say tongue-in-cheek, you know, in order to heal, you got to be out of your mind. That's getting to the point where we're willing to be out of the mind.
I've been told by some people that I'm out of my mind. So I guess we're on a path in healing.
It's often a compliment if you're on the right track.
Yeah. The other thing that really jumped forward for me in the second piece has to do with the Beatitudes, as an outgrowth and a really close cousin, if you will, to the material you talked about yesterday. And in the discussion that you have presented, Tuve Hun is a key word that involves, I think, setting properly of Rachma and Kubha. And
yes, it would.
To me, that also ties into the Enlightenment book that you worked on and re-edited recently to re-include or include again Yeshua's protocol, that the source of our guidance needs to be from God's law, which would tie right back into having Rachma for neighbor, self, anybody, God, neighbor, self. So for those in the audience that are interested in making a further, a deeper dive, it's a really fun experience to go through the reflecting on what Tuve Hun and setting a Rachma and Kubha means, and then rediscovering what the Beatitudes are all about. Because those are truly very practical steps in living within an accurate perception and leading toward, hopefully, the world that we want to create.
Profound set of instructions for sure. And I can remember, you know, I was always taught it was a nice philosophy. And it wasn't until, and I don't know if you've done this, I think I suggested this to you before, but to take the Enlightenment book and write the Beatitudes out longhand using the definitions in the back of the book where the key words are left in Aramaic.
I don't recall that. Something I will actually try. Thank you.
It'll take the whole thing to another level for you. You know, ignore the translations that I've put in the spaces. Just take the key words and look them up in the dictionary. And, you know, you've kind of got to grok them for yourself, just exactly what this means, and write each of those definitions in longhand. And it wasn't until the second time that I did that, you know, pen and paper, did it longhand, that it was just like a light went off. Oh, my God, this is a set of instructions. This isn't a nice philosophy. This is how to.
Well, that is tremendously important, and thank you for reminding me. I do now recall that you had said something about that when we were discussing this some many months ago. And when I did, I've done one class, a beta test of my understanding of the Beatitudes, and there's a lot of material now that I'm working on and re-editing, but I guess the point is experiencing the dynamic in a group who is for the first time being introduced to these Aramaic concepts and the absolute, in some cases, shock at how different what's listed in the Bible, that you read in the Bible, and what people have learned and glossed over now is speaking to them in a very different way. And it was just remarkable to watch the reactions of people in the group.
Well, you stimulate a thought that Yeshua had when he was talking to the scholars of the day. And when he says to them, you swallow a gnat and you strain a camel. And, you know, it's like there's so many huge things that are, or pardon me, you strain a gnat and swallow a camel, the reverse of that. And there's so many huge things that people just ignore. And they go after this little tiny, you know, piece that is irrelevant compared to the truth of what's there. And those Beatitudes, when we understand them as instructions and begin to work with them, are just really profound. And for me, four things come together relative to this conversation. One is Rachma, the second one is Kuba, that they are aligned. And then following the instructions that are given in the Beatitudes, a third factor steps in, and that is this latent neural structure that within us, according to the Beatitudes, the Creator put a guidance system to guide us to happiness and well-being. So that and the word there is that tattoo, an attitude of mind, a literal structure in the mind that when it is at the root of the perceptual output of our minds, it's going to keep our minds on track. And then the fourth factor that comes in that's so important, you know, unique to the Aramaic, never spoken of in any realistic form or fashion that I know of by the Greeks, is Ruka Dekutcha, that there is this literal, actual feminine elemental force in us that if we invite her into activity, she will undo the effects of ours and will teach us the truth, will literally give us direct instruction. And ultimately, that's what this whole body of work is about, is to support each person going back to that themselves, individually, and of course, collectively.
That's awesome. Yeah. Well, I just wanted to call and thank you for the conversation about it. And whoever the caller was who raised the question, I think Jeannie said it came surfaced out of the chat room or a previous conversation, perhaps from Dr. Tim's show that I did not get to hear. It's given me the last 24 hours is an opportunity to revisit some things and make some edits and add. Clearly add some material that will be very helpful. So I appreciate
Sweet.
That.
Well, it's good to hear your voice. Haven't heard your vibration in a significant amount of time. So nice to hear from you.
I'm still here. I guess you could say that I'm still idling in the driveway.
Okay.
I'm getting ready. Getting ready for a trip.
Now, is that a metaphor you're talking about, or are you literally getting ready to go on a trip?
You've used that before. No, I'm not literally going on a trip. This
okay.
is about
okay.
me and my journey and what I share about your work and bringing in other work, other sources and materials that are very similar, not as unique as the Aramaic material. But I think they're very complementing pieces that I'm more familiar with and would like to incorporate. So lots of opportunity to showing up and great time to be alive, buddy. It's,
It is an awesome time for sure.
Well,
for sure. I'm with you on that.
I'm complete. So I thought I'd just call in and thanks and share my two cents, and you're welcome to it.
Okay.
And if there's nothing there, then let's move on.
Awesome. Well, if I called you in about 32 or 33 minutes when the show's over, would you be available?
I would be approximately 2 o'clock my time, or I guess our time. I have another call, so perhaps after 3.
Okay.
I'll be around this afternoon is what I'm saying. Yeah.
Okay. Sounds good.
All right.
All right. Blessings.
Great. Blessings. Bye-bye.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye. All right, Miss Cindy, we're about the halfway point. Do we have anybody else out there with a hand up in the phone queue or anybody in the chat room with a thought for us? Great.
So it's Julie from, I'll start say Ashland, Oregon. She's not from there anymore. Welcome, Julie.
Midland, Oregon? Is it Midland you're in now?
It was Ashland, and I'm only 10 miles away, so you can say Ashland. I might as well. I might move back anyway, so... Hi, you guys. Was that Terry? Who was that that was just speaking?
That was Grady.
Grady.
Grady Lowe. Oh, I knew his voice. I wanted to give him a message about the Aramaic Beatitudes. I hope he's still listening. Something that I've found to be very a very beautiful experience is listening to the CD sets that Dale Allen Hoffman has put out over the years, because he studied with you, Michael, and just letting Grady know that and everyone else. And that was his inspiration, I believe, to go further and become a scholar of his own in the Aramaic and to teach from that. And I think the one that, it's called Home in the Emptiness. It's a CD called Home in Emptiness, Yeshua's Original Aromatic Beatitudes. And he goes through and uses the Aramaic words to literally define them or translate. And what I'm trying to get across is the beautiful, smooth, powerful language the Aramaic is, and to hear someone who speaks it. And he'll read them and go over each or several words or phrases in the Aramaic, and he repeats these words so much, and I've listened for years, and it just always sets my mind in Rachma, you know.
Cool.
And I wanted to recommend that. And Dale has, you know, a website and everything where you can order these things. and he often has sales where you can get a whole lot of his CDs in a set, and it's a really reasonable price. I guess he's at DaleAllenHoffman.com. And Allen is spelled with an E, and Hoffman is spelled with an A at the end of man, Hoffman. And Dale is Dale. Allen, Allen, Hoffman, Hoffman.com. So thank you, Michael. I felt that you would probably be okay with me saying that, because you have had many experiences with Dale, which maybe you'd like to share, and I'm complete.
Yeah, there's a whole year of Aramaic Fridays that we did with Dale, so back in the archives from... I'm not even sure what year. Jeannie, do you remember what year that was? 2012?
2014, I think.
14. Yeah.
I love
it. So people can go back to the archives every Friday for a year. We did that. And we have a 4-hour video that we did with him called Aramaicisms, which is a term that I coined to represent our efforts to bring back the first century meanings of the Aramaic words, which are so... profound in their meaning.
Yeah, and just, you know, using the words like you teach about words, you know, I mean, the vibrational truth in them and resonance, right? It's just, it ignites in me a recognition of all that's being taught. It just rings so true for me. But I'm a musician. I'm kind of an audible person. So, well, anyway, I have to go. I'll be listening, but I just wanted to communicate that. And thank you, and see you later today.
All right. Blessings. See you at
bye-bye.
6 o'clock. 6 o'clock our
6
time.
O'clock.
All right. Blessings. Bye-bye.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Bye-bye.
Yeah, an interesting thing about the Aramaic language is that the structure of the Aramaic letters, according to at least one researcher, is actually, if you're able to set the letters up in a 3D mode, that they're actually 3D shadows of the atomic structure of the universe. Different atomic structures, if you were to shine a light through them and see a 3D shadow, you'd see the Aramaic letters of the alphabet. So it's the only language that's actually rooted in the creation. Every other language is rooted in some man or woman's mind. Oh, we have this grunt, and we decide to make this grunt mean this and that grunt mean that, and we call it language. And, you know, the truth is, all of it's babble. We're babbling right now. Somebody made up a meaning for words. Now, to the degree that we agree on those meanings, we can communicate. But if somebody doesn't have the same meanings, they're going to look at us and go, what are you talking about? That doesn't make any sense. And so our effort has been to go back to that original Aramaic language and do the best we can to bring those meanings forward. And oftentimes, like for instance, the word that Grady brought up, tuvehun, it's a three-part word. And it takes a whole paragraph. I mean, there's no such concept in the English language, in the Roman or the Greeks. There's no such such concept as tuvehun. And so it takes a paragraph to understand what that means from the Aramaic, to at least start to get to meaning. So tuvehun basically would be, it says that a latent neural structure, a tuv, implanted by the Creator to guide us to happiness and well-being becomes your conscious possession, you who, and then, and that's the precursor to each one of the Beatitudes. So before every Beatitude, there's this word tuvehun. And what's being said is, if you follow these instructions, here it is. This is how you activate that neural structure that the Creator determined should be just under the surface. You know, many people live, you know, in a world where, I mean, you just have to give them the slightest look and it's rage and it's condemnation and nastiness. And that's what's just under the surface for them. The Creator determined upon our creation that something else should be just under the surface. And that's what's being spoken about with the Beatitudes. And it's an instruction set. As I say, this goes back 35 years ago, writing it out longhand. Actually, it's more than 35 that I sat down and took the Aramaic translations and the meanings of the key words and wrote it out longhand. And it was just like the second time I went through it, it was just like this bingo experience. Oh, my goodness. This is how to activate this neural structure. Isn't it about being in some sort of, you know, nice philosophical place? Application becomes key. Otherwise, something else is below the surface. And it's time for us to clean up what's below the surface. You know, that was kind of where we started at the beginning of the show, with feelings or emotions, our guidance system. That our emotions tell us what's going on inside of us. And if it's not in alignment with that tube that the Creator put in place, then we do all kinds of crazy things to ourselves, to each other, to the people around us. You know, there's an interesting song that was, you know, pretty popular years ago that reflects when that tube is not active. And the song title was, the melody line of the song was, "You only hurt the one you love." What does that mean? It means that what's beneath the surface is some sort of unresolved hostility or fear from the past that, when tipped into action through resonance, it's just too easy to make your brain's image of someone else out of it and now find a way to puke on them for what they've done to you, quote unquote, done to you, that you've done to yourself again and again and again. And so the willingness to be responsible and step back into cleaning up that carbon-based memory system becomes key in this process of healing and wholeness, and leads to the expression that Yeshua was working to offer to and transfer to people. So, Miss Jeannie, do we have anybody else out there in the phone queue with the hand up? Anything happening in the chat room?
No, on both parts. No hand up and nothing. No questions in the chat room. We had a friend that asked us to hold them in the space, George and Michaela. Do you want to mention that?
Absolutely. And I don't know if Julie's still there. I meant to bring that up in conversation while she was on the phone. It was actually Julie who originally introduced George and Michaela to us, into the work. And we got a note from him yesterday that he's been through some significant physical challenges in his life. And right now he's in a hospital being treated for COVID. He's been in there about a week, and he says he's coming up the other side. But I just want to let him know that we're here holding a space for him as he goes through that process. Unfortunately, you know, sparking, picking up when we got that note, I called him and said hello, and we had a bit of conversation. He sounds like he's doing pretty well. He's going to move through and be fine on the other side. And Michaela, I didn't reach her. I tried, but didn't reach her. But she's at home with COVID. I guess not having quite as many challenges as George, but we just extend our love to both of you and hold you in our hearts and invite everybody in our audience to just take a minute and tap into George and Michaela. Holding you in love. Of course, as we do that, we extend that love to anyone and everyone who's facing challenges around this whole COVID thing, the financial challenges that people are going through. It's interesting how much of it's been turned into some sort of a political football, and, you know, want to blame some politician, more of the blame game over what's happening. And, you know, the problem is there's this weakened immune system that people have that makes them vulnerable to this organism. And, you know, turning one's anger and rage into political footballs, and this is the effort to do this to us and that to us. It's like, well, it's certainly created a lot of problems, but what's created a problem is the fact of COVID, the fact of this disorder going through the culture, and the fact that we can be responsible for our immunity and step our immunity up and strengthen ourselves, move to the other side, and in the meantime, hold space for everyone who's been touched by this flood of energy throughout the culture. We hold you in our hearts and healing and hopefulness of a better day to come soon for everyone, financially, emotionally, relationally, and certainly for those who've had people who've passed as a result of COVID. We hold each of you in our hearts and processing the pain of apparent loss and moving through those trials and traumas. So we're here just being the space, holding the space, reflecting active love to every mind, heart, and being on the planet. And breathing with everyone. Big key to the process of healing is being able to breathe. And so if you're out there in this new land, we've covered quite a bit of territory in 45 minutes. And I can only imagine there are 1,000 questions going on in many minds. And so if you're out there in listener land and you're on one of those, listening on one of those stations where we can't see you in our control panel, our call number is 563-999-3581. If you call that number, you'll be listening to the show And then if you have a question, you push 1. That will raise a hand in the control panel, and Jeannie will know that you want to talk to us, and we'll be having a conversation. So what does that resonate for you? What comes up? You know, it was great to have a tie back in with yesterday's show and the question about Rockman and Cuba, and thanks for bringing that to the next level, Grady, of refinement and bringing forward the next level of understanding. So what kind of questions does all of this arouse for you? Brahma, Kuba, Ruka, Tuvehun, Beatitudes, neural structures. I can't imagine anything other than 1,000 questions swimming around in many persons' heads. And so if you've got a question for us, there's somewhere we can help you to refine that. You know, this work is about building the brain cells so that this carbon-based memory system can produce perceptual constructs that are accurate and based on the truth of the energy that's moving within the creation, rather than the perceptual constructs being based in simply what's moving within carbon-based memory. And our offering is that hostility and fear are indicators that one is caught in a perceptual construct that is false. A perceptual construct based in some form of hostility or fear is itself informing you that your perception is off base. And so the idea of forgiveness is to bring the mind to a state of corrected perception so that whatever the mind feeds to us, its energy feed is in alignment with the truth of what the energy movement is within the creation. You know, if you've ever stood sat in a courtroom, and listened to 6 different people testify about an accident they all witnessed, you could often wonder if any 2 people were at the same accident. Their descriptors are so different. Why are they so different? Because each observer, while they think they observed the accident, did not observe the accident at all. What each observer did was observed what was moving in their own minds. Only the person who was out of their mind and in their higher intuitive faculties could actually experience what happened directly. Otherwise, most people's experience in every instant of their lives is a reflection not of the actuality, but whatever it is that the actuality, what actually occurred, resonates within the individual. So let's use a simple example. You know, the facts of the case are that there was a guy driving a car that went through a red light and hit a woman in another car. That's the actuality. But the person with a bias, let's say, for instance, against women drivers, who knows that women drivers are just terrible and always at fault, gets up and testifies that they saw the woman drive through the red light and hit the man. And that individual is not lying about what they saw. The event occurred, and because of the bias that individual had against women drivers, their mind literally generated a perceptual construct that showed them the woman running the light. They saw her do it. It never happened, but they saw her do it. If you're in hostility or fear about something, you're in hostility or fear about something that never happened. You say, but everybody attests to that event occurred. Well, maybe the event occurred, but the thing that there's hostility and fear about is what's moving inside of you. And if you want to be with your world of hostility or fear, then what you do is you apply forgiveness to any perceptual construct that comes out of hostility or fear. Because hostility and fear are indicators that the mind is using corrupt data to produce its perceptual constructs. Applying forgiveness removes the hostility and fear at the root of distorted perception. Now, you'll notice that the Greeks have taught us that forgiveness is about how I'm going to let you off the hook for what's happening inside of me. Well, if you're around this work very long, you're going to hear me say, never forgive anybody for anything. And many people, even people who've been around the work for a significant time period, become quite confused. It's like, well, but wait a minute, Michael. I thought this was all about forgiveness. Absolutely. This is all about forgiveness. Well, then how dare you say I shouldn't forgive them? Well, here's how I dare say that, is because forgiveness has got nothing to do with them. The Greeks taught us a lie. The Greeks taught us that pardoning was forgiveness. So I'm supposed to let you off the hook for what's happening inside of me and call that forgiveness? If I do that, I'm mistaken. So if I choose to pardon you, okay, you did something really bizarre and off the wall, so I'm going to let you off the hook for that. If you choose to do that, that's a nice thing to do, can be very appropriate, but that's not forgiveness, it's pardoning. Call it what it is, and then go about doing your forgiveness work. And forgiveness is the tool with which you go inside your own perceptual system, access energetic patterns that are not based in love, and remove them from your mind. That's the act of forgiveness. So when I talk about forgiveness, I'm never referring to letting somebody else off the hook because something painful is moving in you. I'm talking about literally directly accessing the root of the pain that you're experiencing and removing it from your structure. And if you haven't engaged in that process yet, we invite you to go to our website, whyagain.org. And when you get to the homepage, if you look in the upper left-hand corner, you'll see a link that says Start Here, very tippy top of the page on the left. Click that link, and it'll start walking you through a whole series of links, page after page after page, on how to understand and how to apply first-century Aramaic forgiveness to remove hostility and fear from your mind. You can do the step-by-step forgiveness worksheet process right there on the website. You can download one of several different versions of the guide sheet for that. It's called the Reality Management Wake Up Sheet. And you can print those on your printer, so you can do them in writing at your own home. You can also go to your app store on your phone, whether you've got an Android or an iPhone. Type in the words Heartland, H-E-A-R-T-L-A-N-D, all one word, Aramaic, A-R-A-M-A-I-C, forgiveness. Type those words in, you're going to be looking at the world's, as far as I know today, only forgiveness app. Created, thank you, by Jeannie. Many early hours that she put into creating that as she worked with some technical support people in India to create the app. And you can download the app free. It's purposely designed to be as private as it can possibly be, which means almost no permissions. You know, oftentimes you load an app on your phone and it wants to control your camera, wants to be able to send texts, and it wants to be able to make phone calls and blah, and access your content. None of that. The only permission you need to give for the app to work is permission for the app to work. That is, it has to be able to use the internet. When you complete doing one of the two versions of the worksheet, if you choose to keep a record, you can hit a print button and print a PDF of it, so you'll have a record. And then it will ask you for a second permission, and that, of course, is that it has to store it somewhere. So it's going to ask for permission to store it. But otherwise, there are no permissions required. The app has been very purposely designed to make sure that whatever you put in it is yours. It's private. No one else can see it. No one else has access to it but you. And so you can trust that you can put, you can tell that app anything. You know, let out your most secret, deepest thoughts. It's only for your use. And if you shut, if you complete a worksheet and you shut the app down, it goes back to the digital world. There's nothing left of it. If you choose to write a PDF and save it, then you have the only access to that piece of information. And we do recommend that people keep a record of the worksheets that they do, because in the future there are more gifts to be given by those worksheets. So there are different ways that you can access the information, and we've got about 4 minutes left. Do we have anybody out there, Jeannie, with a hand up in the phone queue or anything happening in the chat room?
We do have a Skype caller. So
great. Let's say hello to our Skype caller.
You're on the air.
I wonder if this might be Peter.
This is Peter.
It is. Well, welcome, young man from Sweden. How are you?
Well, I am great. I did have a question. I don't know if there's time enough, but...
Well, let's go for it.
I had the experience very clearly that something happened, actuality, and my perception went down this road, and I saw myself, I caught myself, and I heard my mind saying, so bring conscious, active love to this situation, and the healing process will take place.
Yes.
And although I was able to stop myself in... stop my mind, as she says, stop my mind there, and aiming for the conscious, active, present love, it felt very artificial.
Yes.
That's kind of my question.
Okay. Well, I understand that quite well. Been there, done that. I can say I want to bring this state of love forward. But if there's this mass, and you know, in some cases, there are generations and generations of hostility or fear behind it, it's like a battle that goes on. And it's been referred to as the Battle of Armageddon, where who's going to run this show anyway, carbon-based memory or being, my creative essence, love? And the process is one of love, the truth of the being that you are, wrestling back control of your own mind and body. Because you can, you know, intend and want to go in a particular direction, but if there's this massive energy, you know, I've got a dump truck over here that's filled with soil, and I want it to be in the garden, but wanting it to be in the garden and taking out the shovel and shoveling into the garden are two different things. So what I hear you saying is you've entered into, in regard to this particular issue, a new level of processing whatever it is that your carbon-based memory holds around what was resonated by this issue. And welcome to the process. That's awesome.
And I'm thinking it is me being able to stop it is because it has been weakened in its energy by doing the process of forgiveness previously.
Exactly. That's what
and
happens.
Yet,
yes.
Yet in
and we're
like
going to
today,
just carry the conversation on. The show's going to cut us off. I just want to say that our conversation is going to trail off. But go ahead. We'll carry as long as we can.
So even though it did feel a bit artificial, just to the best of my ability to actually in the midst of happening, just do it.
Just do it.
That's what I hear you say.
Next layer. Clear out the next layer. Clear out the next layer. You know, I want the dirt from the dunk truck tree over there. I'm going to do it shovel full by shovel full by shovel full. If hostility or fear is in my mind, I'm going to clean it out worksheet by worksheet by worksheet until there's no room. You know, you've heard me say before that there's a line in the Lord's Prayer that, or what was called the Lord's Prayer, that can be properly translated as asking the Creator, carve out a space in me for your wholeness. Whatever this issue has resonated for you, my offering would be, that would be your request, is carve out a space for me, for being, for love, to be present with this, which is moving in my carbon-based memory. Probably a generational pattern.